through looking at the vibrational motion this morning on the neutron interferometer, and one small more piece that I want to tell you about with that, and then we'll race through talking about spins. So when we're looking at the coherence length, I mentioned that we could use two prisms to offset the two beams relative to one another. And so we drew this on edge so that we could see that, that one of the beams, well, they both start off at the same place, of course. One we could raise. And then if we simply block this beam, we don't care about it, and we look out here, we put the phase flag, and if this dimension, delta z, if delta z, delta kz is bigger than one, then there's no contrast here. But of course, the neutron interferometer doesn't actually limit our choice of z very much at all. Because remember that the planes that we're diffracting on run that way. And so they're absolutely uniform along z. So if I vary the z momentum, as long as I keep kx and ky fixed, then it doesn't matter very much. So let's go into this range where delta z is big. Because we don't limit the momentum in the z direction, then of course the coherence length is short, right? The coherence length is 1 over the spread of momentum. So we have this narrow little wave packet along the z direction. And one of the nice things you can do is we can put another crystal here. We can put a crystal that we orient along the z direction. So we have here, let's look at it in this way. We've got these two beams coming in, delta z. And remember what we're talking about here. We're saying that we have a wave function that we want to specify by two quantities, whether it's, I don't like that nomenclature. I'm going to take delta z to be a qubit. The two states are delta z equals 0 and delta z equals delta z. Isn't that a horrible notation? But it says that we have these two parallel paths, right? And of course, the beam is still a big beam, right? But every neutron is in a coherent superposition of taking these two paths. Yeah? Perfect. All right. So now then we do something that says we put a thick crystal oriented along the z direction now. And we arrange that the beams get diffracted into each other. So we orient the crystal so that the blades better be going this way, because we're still in the Lowy scattering pattern, so that the Bragg scattering puts those two beams back together. And now, when I look here for the contrast, what do I see? Remember, we we lost contrast because we had a term that went like e to the I delta z kz, and there was a distribution, a classical probability distribution of kz, right? So we restore the contrast for those neutrons that diffract into this detector, right? Because for those, we've lost this description. We've effectively lost this qubit. There's no description of z or delta z. So this is an example of post-selection. Because we removed the dependence that was leading to that phase shift, then we recover the contrast. And we're going to see another example of that with spin. Okay. So again, go through the calculation and see that. Now, so we take neutron interferometry and we add spin. And the neutron is spin 1/2. So now then we have 2 qubits. The path degrees of freedom. And the spin degrees of freedom and the way we normally run the experiment is we put the entire experiment in a relatively weak magnetic field oriented along the z direction. So we add a field, it's along the z direction and it's over the entire interferometer. And just to make it concrete, the field is about 10 Gauss. It doesn't need to be a big field. And since this is along the z direction, then of course there's a Zeeman energy. So there's a spin term, which is associated with Zeeman. That is gamma b sigma z. And gamma is 2 pi times 2,000 hertz per Gauss for a neutron. It's about a little bit less than half the magnetic moment of a proton. And of course, what does the Zeeman interaction tell us? The Zeeman interaction tells us that if we put a spin in a magnetic field, it'll precess, it'll rotate about the field direction, right? That's what that says. Okay, so we can assign these now. We know what they mean. So this is ms equals plus 1/2 and ms equals minus 1/2, just the projections of along the plus and minus z directions. And of course, to belabor the point, our Hilbert space is spanned by those 4 vectors. Okay, so if we add a qubit now, the second qubit, then there's a few things we can show. Clearly, we ought to be able to look at entanglement. Closely related to that is we can look at spinner behavior. I'm going to show you the third piece that shows that we can use post-selection in an experiment like that. But let's go through the simple first stuff first. Okay. Well, actually, I'll even save myself some room. So the archetype experiment looks exactly like we had before, except here I'm going to put some device that filters out the spin down state. So at this point, we only have spin up. And of course, you know, coming from a reactor, the spin degree of freedom is a really wimpy degree of freedom. And coming from the reactor, the spins are just as likely to be pointed up as pointed down. Of course, there's all sorts of magnetic fields wandering around the labs. So even if they were polarized, they would probably be pointing in some you know, hard-to-find direction. And if we want to go from the fully mixed state, so we're saying that at this point, what do we have? You know, we have in the zero path tensor identity on the spin degree of freedom, right? So to go from here to there, clearly we need to do something non-unitary, right? The eigenspectrum of those two is very different. And so we say, there can't be anything more non-unitary than to reach in and every time you find a spin down neutron, throw it away. And that's what we do. Now we do it in two ways. The nicest way, as I mentioned before, is to take a gas of helium-3 and polarize it. And that's an easy thing to do. It's a standard experiment in physics junior labs to spin polarize rubidium. You guys done that in your junior labs? No? We need to have some experimental program here. Okay, you can optically pump rubidium and you can force it into a spin state. And rubidium will spin exchange in the gas phase with helium. So as we're pumping rubidium, if we have it in helium or in xenon, we can spin polarize those gases. And because the lifetime is very long for those gases, if you polarize and you just keep doing it for a while, you can get very high polarizations. So we can do that. The other way of doing it is something called a supermirror, which is a lot of magnetic films that will absorb one spin state and the other one is transmitted. But let's think about this one. So we have spin up, right? Yeah, it's hard to get a big enough magnetic field gradient. So it's very appealing to say, let's put a big magnetic field gradient. We'll take our neutrons and we'll arrange it so that the spin up neutrons go where we want and spin down neutrons are meandering around. And there was a group at Novosibirsk that spent some years trying to make an interferometer out of this. Of course, you can imagine that once you've done this, right, you've got these things moving out. You can try to shape the field so that the two paths are together. And then you can do the inverse of this. And you can put them back together. You can make an interferometer. But in fact, the separation that you get here is pretty small. It's of order microns for the fields we can realistically make. Okay. So now we've got this spin here. And of course, when we go through this first blade, the blade doesn't care about spin, right? The blade's just going to give us, just going to care about the path degrees of freedom. So the state that we have at this point is, again, tensor, spin up. No change. And so here, I want to put a spin flipper. I want a pi rotation, let's say about x. It doesn't make any difference for the spin. So that following this, in this path, the spin is down, and in this path, the spin is up. And now then, here we have this beautiful state. And we're nicely entangled. And then, of course, we can put in a phase flag. The phase flag doesn't care about spin. The mirror doesn't care about spin. This final blade doesn't care about spin. And so at this point, we end up having a state which is still entangled. It's easy to calculate. I'll let you do that. You have all the information. And we're left with asking the question, how are you going to prove that it's entangled? Right? So now then, clearly we have an entangled state. But here, what do I have to change about the measurements if I want to show that it's entangled? Yeah, that's right. So we can either take one of these filters and put it here, or we could take the helium-3 detectors that we have and spin polarize those so that they only capture the neutrons with the inverse of the spin. Okay. And so what I'd like you to do is to take this and look at the concurrence. Yeah, I should be able to spell. There, you can't read it anyways. Look at the concurrence of this with the same errors that you had before. Theta of the path and sigma of the face. And ask, when is the concurrence consistent with having an entangled state? Okay, so now let's turn to spinner degree of freedom. The spinners. Now you've heard, of course, about spinners forever. And the basic idea, of course, is stuck in this unitary. So we're looking at the unitary of a 1-qubit rotation. And if I look at u of 2 pi, let me see, we pick up this -1. And of course, if I have 1 qubit, there's nothing I can do, right? Because this is now a global phase. And so in order to determine, to see spinner behavior, what we need to do is to embed it in an interferometer. So we have some other phase to reference it to. And of course, we have that right here. So we can take and make this rotation now some arbitrary angle. We still have to keep that we've polarized in the first place. Okay. And so we start off after the first blade. Like so. We're then again going to create this entangled state. Like so. And now you go ahead, put in a phase flag here. Etc. Put in your spin filter here. Keep only that state. And look at this. All right. So we show you some pictures. That's not so interesting. Go ahead and look at the experiment. I don't know how much of this you can see, but it's just the same rotations that we had before. We get our nice matrices. And this is the only piece that matters. So here, what I've plotted is the O-beam intensity, so that's on this axis, versus the phase that we set the phase flag, versus the angle that I've rotated the spin by. And the phase flag goes from 0 to 2 pi. Exactly as we want, we see the contrast. The spin rotation goes from 0 to 4 pi. And so we see that, yes, we do get, in fact, this doubling of the spinner dynamics over that degree of freedom because we've put it inside. We said that we're only going to have, I should have said this, but you knew it anyways, that U of the spin is equal to identity. I've been putting the spin, the path first. It's equal to 1 tensor identity plus 0 tensor e to the I theta over 2 sigma x. And I had asked you to look at some time ago, looking at taking a matrix exponential with one of these idempotents in it. And to show that you can effectively take the idempotent out of the matrix exponential and multiply it by it. So you can apply the same tricks here. So don't get worried that it appears directly there. Okay. Now, spinner degrees of freedom. You know, they seem pretty boring, but there's actually something we can do with it. And that's what I want to tell you about. So to make use of even such a simple experiment as this. But before I do that, I want to spend a few minutes saying actually how we can do either of these rotations. Because it turns out to be not so simple. So let's say we want to have a spin rotation. We have a few choices, but the nicest looks like this. We take some permanent magnetic material, and I'm going to have the fields running in the film along the long direction. We're going to put this here inside the interferometer. So it's a magnetic film. And here we need to put it on something, so it's a silicon substrate. And the magnetic film is limited in thickness to about 5 microns. The reason is, if you make it thicker, you're going to end up with domains that are not all pinned. So that would be a disaster, right? So that depending upon where you went through the film, you would see a different magnetic field. So we want the film to have a uniform magnetization, so it needs to be thin. The substrate for processing needs to be about 500 microns or thicker. That's about the thinnest one you can have. Now, if I have 5 microns film, remember that normally we think of doing a rotation by saying apply some field for some time. So the neutron's coming through, it's going through the interferometer, and there's a field sticking out of the interferometer in the z direction, right? So it always sees a field, it's always in this direction. And then abruptly, non-adiabatically, diabatically, it should see a field in the direction of the film. And so, which is this direction. So that should be a diabatic shift. But it's going 2,000 meters a second, which is really slow, but it still only takes 2.5 nanoseconds to go through 5 microns. And the field, well, if you saturate a magnet, then the best you can get with a ferromagnet is 2 tesla, or 2 × 10⁴ Gauss. And so the rotation is 2.5 nanoseconds times 2 × 10⁴ Gauss times 2 pi times the gyromagnetic ratio, 2,000 hertz per Gauss. And if you work it all out, it's 0.1 times 2 pi. And so it's a small rotation, right? It doesn't get us 180 degrees. We wanted 180 degrees. And of course, we can tilt the film, just like we tilted the phase flag, and make the path longer, right? So I can take the film, and I can put it like this, and we have our neutrons coming in. And so the path becomes a little bit longer, but it can't become that long. There's only so much space between these. And look at what happens here. Remember, we've still got our field in this direction. And here our field is in that plane. And the spins all come in with the phase lined up, with their spin lined up to the external magnetic field. But when they leave, they're going to process in the external magnetic field. And this extra range of precession is going to be a phase distribution, so we're going to lose contrast. I'll get so complicated, huh? So we need to put another film here. So that the total length of time is exactly the same. And Here we have something like 36 degrees about the y-axis, and then we have something like 3 degrees about the z-axis. So this effective rotation axis starts off with the spins along z. I want them to get to minus z, but this effective rotation is about some axis that's lifted up from z. Let's call it z prime, right? Because we've got that z rotation there. So the effective rotation axis is not perfectly along y. And this would rotate in a cone, and it would never reach minus z, right? The only if z prime is equal to, only if y prime is equal to y, can I rotate that to minus z. Okay. So what do we do? What we do, let me see if we can't see this better. What we do is we start off with the rotation with the spins along z. Then we have a y rotation, and I've drawn in light that entire this cut, that light piece there. This entire cone that's going to rotate through, right? So it'll rotate through a cone. So I've drawn that. And as I change alpha, I'm just changing the how far away from the y-axis the y prime axis is. That's all that parameter is doing, okay? Now, as long as the y prime axis is within 45 degrees of the y axis, then one point of this cone will, in fact, hit the xy plane. Yeah? And if, remember, I want to get here, I want to get to minus z. But this would rotate that into a cone as well. Right, it would rotate it into this cone. And that's the other color one that you see here. Right? But of course they don't meet unless y is equal to y prime. So what we do is we rotate the first one until we're exactly in the xy plane. Then we shift the time between those two until it rotates around to exactly this point. And then we rotate, put the second film in that's going to take it here. Okay, so we do this by a composite rotation of three rotations that makes it look like we've done a perfect pi rotation. So we have some angle about y prime, and then some other angle about z, and the same angle about y prime again. And this thing is exactly equal to a pi rotation about y. So we can directly get it pointing down. And of course, we could put it anywhere in the Bloch sphere by this. So we start off with a rotation that wouldn't reach a large area of the Bloch sphere, and now we can get to anywhere we like. Yeah.
So what accomplishes the green rotation?
The magnetic field in the guide hall. So this B field. So all we have to do is move these things apart from each other. Okay, so some details. So now then we can do a rotation of the spins. And the nice thing is the rotation of the spins is perfect. Or it's just very close to perfect. It's hard to find, if you set it correctly, it's hard to find an error in the spin degree of freedom. And so on the one hand, he says, oh, great, we have, you know, a qubit that effectively doesn't have noise to it. But the nice thing about this interferometer is these two paths are very, very well separated. So if I'm going to look at some materials or I'm going to look at an aspect of quantum information processing, I want to do things on the path degree of freedom because they're separated from each other and gives me either a spatial degree of freedom or a place that I can put a sample that I can create a coherence with, right? I can put a sample here and know that it's not in that blade. You can't do the same thing with the spin degree of freedom. Okay, so let's see how we do it. So we're going to again come in with the spin in the up state. I'm going to again put the flipper. I want a pi pulse, so the spin is in the down state. And I'm going to do something horrible. I'm going to just put in one prism to create a face over all the z degrees of freedom. So now then I have e to the I have this operator. And remember that when we wrote it before, this piece we called Q, right? So we have e to the I QZ DZ divided by 2. Right, so for every, for our beam of neutrons coming through, this 2 millimeter by 8 millimeter beam, right, for every orientation, there's a different phase of the neutrons. Not spins, but the different phases of the neutrons, right? So we have this spatial helix of phases. If I did this, then you would tell me, I hope, that there's no contrast in the interferometer, right? That like simply putting a phase, a random phase here, you know, you say, oh, well, it's uniform, you know, it's changing simply in space, but it's still at the detector, looks like a random phase. That here, contrast, with this piece, contrast goes to zero. What I want you to calculate is to put a filter here, spin filter, but detect the spin along the x direction. Rotate the spin filter so that we're looking at the spin along the x direction. We're only filtering x, not z. Just x. And you'll remember, of course, that we can think about x as a coherent superposition of spin up and spin down, right? So what's going to happen here? Let me tell you first. We return some contrast. So bunch of gibberish. But at the end of the day, I calculate an output matrix that depends upon this parameter A, which is a phase. And it's a phase in the phase flag. And the rest of the experiment is exactly as I've drawn it there. And then when I look at the matrix for that, we see that A drops out. So I could integrate it over A, but I'll get the same thing. And we nicely see that there's coherence in there. There's a coherence in a particular manifold, right? There's a coherence only in this place here. If I looked in this particular manifold, there's no coherence, of course. Okay, but in this manifold, or if I looked here or here, right? There's coherence. Where did it come from?
Is this just the prism like we talked about previously?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
A here is?
A is this angle. So let me tell you why we're going to do this. I'm not going to answer your question. You have to answer this question. When we built the last interferometer we built, we found that the contrast was an abysmal 20% because of the phase variation over the blade was horrible. And it's just accepted in the field, we don't accept it, but others do, that you try these things and you get what you get. But it's a lot of work to get out something that you're not happy with. And so we asked the question, could we use a quantum code to return interference to an interferometer, even when the phase noise is so big that you wouldn't see interference. And we have a resource. The resource is that the spin degree of freedom is so clean. Now, of course, it's not going to help us to try to make more and more paths. You could say, oh, well, why don't you make a decoherence-free system? But, of course, the noise is not correlated from blade to blade, right? It's just some random noise. So you really do need to use the spin degree of freedom. Now, let's ask a question. Let's say that I'm measuring this state along sigma x. So what I'm saying is that the measurement operator in the z basis is this, right? We're measuring just one of the sigma x, the projection along plus sigma x, say. Okay. So I've got this piece, that's what I'm measuring. Now, if the spin was up, and I was looking here, what would I measure? Well, if we went back to the Stern-Gerlach experiment, this you've all seen. We take and we put the magnetic grating along the z-axis and we split the beam into plus 1/2 and minus 1/2. And I take this plus 1/2 state, and I now put another set of gradients, but I put it along the x-axis. What happens?
Splits again.
Like it's good. Good. And the relative probabilities? 50-50. So I come over here and I say, oh, I'm going to put a spin filter along the x-axis. It's going to keep just the x-up state. And if I didn't have that spin flipper there, so all the spins were in spin up along z, all I would do is absorb half the neutrons. And I would still have no contrast. But half the neutrons would have been gone. Yeah? And let's say that I put a spin flipper in both of these so that all I have is spin down. Be exactly the same story, right? Good. Now here, I've got these two pieces. So let's ask, well, what's the action of that prism? Well, a phase in a neutron interferometer directs the neutrons from going to the O to the H beam, H detector, right? And it doesn't matter. If I looked at a single neutron, it has a well-defined phase. It really did go through one piece of that. And it comes through here, right? And by saying it has a well-defined phase, what I want to say is that, hey, we really do have the state here that is 1 over the square root of 2. That looks like that, right? What happens if I measure along the x-axis? Well, it doesn't make any, yeah, no. Yeah. When you go through the analysis, you'll include this blade. Okay, so there'll be a particular mapping, which is why these lines are zero. But the spin here is going to truly end up being a sigma x or minus sigma x interaction. It truly is going to be spanned by those two. And every piece here that I can rewrite as the path 0 with the spin pointing that way in the x direction is simply going to go through here. So the action of the spin filter says, hey, if you have coherence, keep it. But if you don't have coherence, right? If you have coherence, then these will be combined as a sigma x operator. If you don't have coherence, they're either going to appear as a plus or minus, up or down. If they appear as plus or minus, or as up or down, throw half of them away. But if they appear as sigma x, you keep them all. So at the end of the day, we return coherence to the picture at a cost that the coherence is only a factor of a third. But, you know, a factor of a third is better than zero. So for homework, go through that and show that this X measurement will return contrast to a system. It's another example of post-selection just like this one. Except in this, in this case, we have one qubit and we're post-selecting on momentum to recover contrast for those qubits, for those neutrons that have the correct momentum to be recombined. Over here, we post-select on an ancilla qubit to partially recover contrast on the qubit which is defining the interferometry experiment. Good. Okay, that's everything I had. And that's where I want to end, I think, with this neutron stuff. Yeah, you've seen everything there. So, any questions on neutrons? And what we'll do tomorrow is we'll start looking at diamonds. Okay, you understand, or you've seen more about neutron interferometry than most people. And the diamond stuff is very nice because today we have these small diamond processors which you can imagine putting anywhere and they'll be coherent. So you can picture taking these little diamond quantum sensors or quantum processors and sprinkling them everywhere in the environment and using them as distributed quantum computers. So we'll show you the physics of how that works. Okay.